You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
I just want to introduce our preacher today. As a church, we care deeply about leadership development. We want to be raising, training up leaders to serve and lead in all kinds of various capacities here in our church, including we want to raise people up for the work of preaching. And so several times this summer, you're going to get to hear from different members of our staff team outside of our three pastors. And today, you're going to get to hear from Alex Moser. Alex is a longtime member of our church. He serves as our college minister, and he has been hard at work studying and preparing a sermon for us today in Psalm 126. And so I'm so looking forward to hearing from Alex, but more importantly, to hearing from God himself as he preaches to us through his word.
This morning, as Tina just read, we'll be in Psalm 126, which if you don't have a Bible with you, I would love for you to open that up with me. It's going to be on page 485 of those pew Bibles right in front of you. Each week, if you've been with us this summer, we're going through the Songs of Ascent, which are a collection of Hebrew poems found in the Psalms, where the Hebrew Israelites would go up on their three times a year journey to Jerusalem, and they would recite these songs on their journey while they're traveling. They're kind of like ancient road trip songs. But when we read them today, you might have noticed that they're not really the road trip songs we listen to. Like when I'm driving on a summer road trip, I think of the Beatles, you know? But they don't have the good vibes of the Beatles or the Beach Boys, or the vague lyrics of pop music. They don't kind of lull you into just good feelings. That's because the road's hard. And for ancient people, the road was really dangerous. Imagine carrying 3-5 months of your belongings with you, right? People are going to be hiding on the side of the highway, waiting to take all of your belongings. So the road was something to be afraid of and something that you would need protection in. The road is a metaphor for life. Life is hard. Life is dangerous. And we can lose sight of that with our 21st century comforts. They can kind of give us a little bit of a gap between the danger of life. But it doesn't take that much. It doesn't take that long for those comforts to be stripped away, and you feel it. You feel the harshness, the danger of life. Psalm 126 assumes that you're on the hard road of life. The psalmist assumes that you're well acquainted with the lonely walk, the lonely, desolate places of life. And if we don't get that context, if we don't assume with the psalmist that reality, this psalm that we just read is going to sound naive. And maybe you thought that it was naive or overly optimistic about our future. But the psalms are not naive to life. They show us, they give us a vocabulary for how to speak to God in the middle of the highs, but also the lows of life. What do you say to God when you feel stuck in a job that you don't like and you want to move on? What do you say to God when you're lonely again? What do you say to God when you're depressed and anxious? How do you process that same struggle of sin, that idol of control that just seems like it's never going to get away from you? The Psalms are familiar with all of these emotions. And Psalm 126 assumes that we're there or that we'll be there at some point. So Psalm 126 speaks to us in the desolate place and invites us to sing a song of hope, hope that God will restore us and turn our weeping into joy, our desolate deserts and places into a harvest. That's the theme of our song. That's our big idea, that God restores his people. And we can lean into that reality. We can kind of taste it more fully when we follow the three movements of the song. The first is remember God's restoration. The second is request God's restoration. And the third is sow in hope of God's restoration. I tried to get that third R in there, but it just didn't really work. So remember, request, and sow. Let's look at that first movement. Remember God's restoration in verses 1 through 3. When the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dreamed. Then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with shouts of joy. Then they said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us. We're glad. So we start our psalm by looking back at what God has done. We remember God's restoration. That's why the psalmist says, when the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion. And you might be wondering, I wonder what specific story this is. And we don't get a sense on the specific kind of nature of when this happened, but that's kind of the point. Restoration isn't something that God has done once and we are good with it. No, it's something that God has done over and over again in the story of his people. If you flip back all the way to page 1, Adam and Eve are exiled due to their sin and idolatry of the garden, but God restores them. He draws them near, and he points to a promised restoration through the seed of Eve. Israel, later in the story, is enslaved in Egypt, but God delivers them and restores them to the promised land. And then we have Assyria and Babylon taking them out of the land, taking them captive. And again, God restores them to the land. This is the repeated story of God's people. God's people are in need of restoration due to their sin and idolatry and just the brokenness of the world. And then they call out to God for restoration. And then God gives them restoration. If we're feeling creative, we could call this the restoration cycle. That didn't really land, that's okay. Verse 1 could be about any of these moments of restoration. The point is, restoration is this time of fullness from lack, this time of relief from pain, a time of abundance from famine. Mouths being filled with laughing and people screaming for joy. It's like the story of Moses bringing his people through the wilderness into the promised land, right? The Exodus story. And we have at the end of that story, we have Deuteronomy, which is essentially just one long sermon that Moses is giving to the people right before they get to the land. It's kind of like Moses' last words, really hoping this sticks with them, but it probably won't. And right at the end of that sermon in Deuteronomy 30, Moses gives the Israelites this picture of the future that they'll have with God in the land. And you think it would start off really rosy. That's usually how you start things, but that's not how Moses starts. It's rough. He says that their children, they're gonna be just like their parents. They're gonna turn away from God. They're gonna run after idols. And so God will send them out of the land. The land will become this burnt, desolate wasteland. And eventually they'll be driven out. But that's not the end of it. Moses also talks about that after this judgment, that they'll return to the Lord, that they'll obey his voice with all their heart. And then after this repentance, that God will restore your fortunes and bring you back from all peoples. Not only will they be back in the land, though, Moses talks about how God will circumcise your heart so that you will love the Lord your God. Now, circumcising the heart is a weird phrase, but it just means that God is going to work under the surface. God is going to renovate the heart of his people. He's going to make their hearts new. And this picture, this vision of the future of God's people is picked up in Jeremiah and Ezekiel, but ultimately it's found in the hope of Jesus and the indwelling spirit of the new covenant, that Jesus in the gospel gives us a new heart. But that's why when we read the story of Israel throughout the Old Testament, we see these moments of kind of partying, of mirth, of restoration, of people, you know, David dancing after they've conquered another non-Israelite people. And we think, oh, wait, is this the time? Is this the real deal? Are we good now? But it's never complete. That's because the new heart reality hasn't come. These restorations of Israel are glimpses, they're tastes of the full restoration to come. So when the psalmist remembers these stories, when he looks back, he remembers how God has restored Israel over and over again, but he's also remembering how God will ultimately restore Israel in this new heart reality. in the desolate place, in this hard place, the psalmist has hope because God is the God who restores his people. This is what he does again and again. The psalmist not only remembers the events, he remembers how they felt. We were like those who dreamed, then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongues with shouts of joy. They were like those who dreamed. Now that sounds like a pop song, but what does it mean? As modern people, we think about dreaming as kind of a window into our psyche, something that we'll write down quickly to tell our therapist about so that we can really understand like what's going underneath the surface, right? But for an ancient Israelite, God communicated himself to his people. That's where God met his people, in dreams. God meets Abraham while he's sleeping and makes a covenant with him. God meets Jacob in a dream, and Jacob sees this crazy ladder kind of connecting earth to heaven. God meets Joseph in a dream and communicates how Joseph is going to be used in all of these sorts of ways for God's glory. These points in Israel's story, it's God communicating to his people through dreams. And in every case, it's a surprise. Jacob is in the middle of nowhere and God meets him. Abraham's in the middle of nowhere and God meets him. And this sense of surprise is because God is with them, and it leads to great joy. That's what the psalm is talking about, the surprise of God's presence that leads to laughter and shouts of joy. Now, I had a lot of shouts of joy in the NBA playoffs this past season. I'm now, right now, in a desolate place, so don't ask me about it, but there was mirth with the Dallas Mavs. Several moments of restoration happened. We would be down by 2 points with a minute left. Luka had the ball. He was driving. And really, if you took me in that moment and you asked me, Alex, what are you thinking? I was thinking, Luka, just drive and get us like a 2-point bucket. You know, just get an easy shot. That's all I need from you. Get me to overtime and we'll figure it out. And then he steps back beyond the 3-point line, takes a much, much more difficult shot, and makes it. And I scream. I'm joyous. Hand on my wife thinks it's a bit much, but I'm joyous. I'm full of these shouts of joy. The shouts of joy we experience in these surprises of God being with us is heard by other people, like Hannah when I'm screaming, but by the nations in the psalm. Then they said among the nations in verse 2, the Lord has done great things for them. God's surprising work of restoration fills us up with joy, and that overflows to other people. It overflows to the nations. This is how the gospel works in our lives. The gospel is the good news that Jesus, in his death and resurrection, has done something on our behalf, has done everything on our behalf. And if we think about it, he came to us in such a surprising and shocking way. Jesus taught amongst a backwater people. No one really knew who they were. There's not that much written about them, of the Roman Empire. He had a few followers, but near the end, all of those followers are gone. And then at the real end, it looks like a true Greek tragedy. Jesus is hanging on the cross, bearing the exile for all of us. But in the great surprise of the gospel, Jesus reverses it. Jesus is raised from the dead. Paul gets at the surprise really well in Romans 5, 6 through 8. Paul says, you see, at the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous person, though for a good person, someone might possibly dare to die. That makes sense. That's the way the world works. That's what we would expect. But God does the surprising, the unexpected. In verse 8, but God demonstrates his own love for us in this, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Let that shock us for a bit. We were on a path deserving the worst, judgment. That's all that we should have expected. But God gives us the best. He gives us his steadfast love. And that's true not just yesterday or the time that you first believed it. It's true every day. Every day in our desolate place, we need to remember the good news of Christ's death and resurrection. In your desolate place now, remember that foundational story, that truth that lifts our eyes from our desolate place, that renews us. And maybe you're sitting here and you're thinking, I can't really remember a time like that. The offer here for you is to trust in that good news. If that's not something that you have found yourself remembering and looking back to that moment that you received Christ, the offer right now is to receive that foundational story as your own. The gospel lifts our eyes in the desolate place of the full restoration to come. That's what gives us our hope. So it not only reminds us of it, but it deepens our longing for it, and that moves us to pray for that future restoration now. But when we're in the desolate place, the desert, sometimes we don't have the strength or the courage or the hope to see better things. So what do we do? The psalm gives us two things. We request and then sow. So let's look at verse 4, the psalmist's request of God's restoration. In verse 4, restore our fortunes, O Lord, like streams in the Negev. So we just saw that the psalmist begins by looking back of God's restoration in the past, and it reminds him, oh yeah, wait, God has a promise for a future to come. And it stirs his heart to ask for that restoration now. And we can ask for this. This prayer is for us as well. We know that full restoration comes when Christ returns, but we can ask God to give us a taste now. We can, even as we're in the desert, especially as we're in the desert, we can ask God to surprise us with his grace, to fill our mouths with laughter. That's what he's asking for. Restore our fortunes, O Lord. The request is given an image, like streams in the Negev. The Negev is a dry southern region of Israel. It's where winter rains would suddenly come and dump water for hours, if not for a few days. As you can imagine, water being dumped in a desert, that creates flash flooding. Austin has similar things happening sometimes in the summer. We might have one this week, where dry dirt will just be suddenly so full of water that streams will pop out of nowhere, sometimes right near foundations, which is not great for foundations, but it produces a sudden abundance of life. Some of you might have been to Sculpture Falls, which I'm pointing this way, but I don't really know where Southwest is. It's southwest of here. It's right along the Barton Creek and of the Greenbelt. And it's a great swimming hole when there's water. But for most of the year, it's bone dry. It's kind of just this rock bed of smoothly worn stone that looks cool to look at and to hike near, but there's nothing that much fun to do. But every once in a while, a storm will come, the Colorado River will swell up, water will kind of dump from the neighborhood around it, and Sculpture Falls is all of a sudden this amazing watering hole that you can jump in. What once was just like rock is now a place where dozens of people are jumping and having a lot of fun. And the foliage around it kind of goes from brown to green. That's kind of like the color palette of Austin, I guess. But it's amazing. The Negev is even more dramatic. These dry stream beds called wadis are suddenly flooded and become mini oases full of desert flowers and streams. You might be asking, why are there desert flowers? Well, desert flowers will just like drop their seeds from the previous flood and they'll just be dormant in these like wadi beds, right? And then when the flood comes, they'll be awakened and they'll bloom. It's this amazing idea of surprise again. What once was a drab desert is now an oasis of life. It's a suddenness like a dream. It's a taste of restoration. I love the idea of restoration, something I long for. I long for a day when my anxiety doesn't suddenly strike me in the middle of my workday, when I'm not suddenly just thinking about all the disaster scenarios that could happen to me, where it throws off the rest of my day or week. I long for a day where my mind can fully rest and trust in God. What is it for you? If you were to say this prayer, "Restore our fortunes, O Lord," what would you have in mind? Would it be restore joy in a season of apathy, sadness, depression? Would it be restored health in a season of broken bodies, of disease, illness? Would it be a restored marriage in a season of stalemates and coldness? Would it be restored purpose in a season of people asking you, what are you going to do with your life? And you just don't know. But would you have a restored purpose? What do you long for God to restore? These are the things that we thirst for, that we long for in the desert. They're good things. But here is the hard question that might be in the back of your mind, but let's push it forward. What if we ask God for these things and they don't happen? We don't get them. Sometimes we ask God for things and we don't get them. Nothing changes. That's lonely. That's hard. That is the desolate place, the desert. So what do we do with that? My general exhortation to you would be keep requesting, to keep asking God for restoration. The invitation of this psalm is that God restores his people, and he's promised that. So it's right to long and to seek, to ask God to bring that final restoration to taste now, to request that in every part of life that we feel the gap. And if God delays, if God seemingly doesn't answer, let that deepen your longing. Let that deepen your request to God. Don't let it crush your faith, but let it strengthen you to ask for that restoration that God has promised to bring. And if God does grant it, and if God does give you that thing, let it be a foretaste. Let it be a signpost to God's ultimate restoration to come. Don't hold on to it like it's your salvation. In either way, these requests, these longings, don't let them control you or enslave you, but rather let them drive you in prayer. Let them send you to the Father who knows your need and actually wants you to come to him with those requests. He delights in your requesting. When we remember God's restoration in the past, that leads us to pray for full restoration now, to get the foretaste now. But what do we do when we're done praying? What do we do when the prayer is over? Let's go to our last point. We sow in hope of God's restoration. It's verse 5 and 6. Those who sow in tears shall reap with shouts of joy. He who goes out weeping, bearing the seed for sowing, shall come home with shouts of joy, bringing his sheaves with him. So the psalm ends with this beautiful agrarian image, but it might be a little confusing because that's not really how farming works, I think. We end with a picture of a farmer sowing seed, right? He's sowing in the midst of his grief, though. He's weeping while he works, but then we find the surprise of the joy at the harvest at the end of verse 5. The image is then expanded in verse 6. The farmer goes out weeping, bearing the seed for sowing, and then he comes home bearing armloads of joy with him. It's this extended image of God being with his people, but the farmer going out in his sorrow and working the field, sowing the seed and reaping shouts of joy. It's hard for us to really picture this image. Maybe we just don't understand farming or the existential crises that happen while farming. Because most of us, we just go to HEB and grab the Brussels sprouts and the chicken, right? We don't feel it. But don't get it wrong, we are definitely still existentially dependent on the harvest. Sowing seed is an act of faith that rain will come. It's an act of faith that the soil is even any good to grow the seed. It's an act of faith that that seed will grow up one day and sustain us with food. And if the rain doesn't come, if the soil's bad, if the seed is bad and there's a failure in the crop, that brings grief, sorrow. And then when you go to plant the next season, when you go to sow the next season, it's not like you can just Control-Alt-Delete that failure. No, you bear that failure with you into the next season. But that's the amazing part of the image. There's a promise attached to it. The work of God's people is like that of the farmer. They work amidst their tears, amidst the past of failure, of grief, of sorrow, because we have an assurance of a future harvest. So we're not like a normal farmer in that we have an assured harvest in the future. Some of you this morning carry months, years, decades of unanswered requests for restoration. That is so hard. That is sorrowful. And we bear, and you bear, that sorrow in each new season you enter. We bear the sorrow of previous seasons. What have we sown and not reaped, and how does that lead us to not want to sow again? And how might this image, though, strengthen us to keep going? The hope of this image is that we can reinvest our sorrow into the next season. The sorrow can deepen our prayer, it can deepen our work, it can deepen our sowing. The offer, the promise of this future restoration in the gospel actually moves us to work. It moves us to sow while we weep. This idea of sowing and reaping reminds me of my grandpa. He was a gardener, but that's not the reason why I thought about it, but I just made that connection now. I guess a lot of people are gardeners, so I'm aspirationally a gardener. But he was in this prayer small group for 20 to 30 years. 6 a.m. Mondays, they met weekly. It was a handful of men at my grandpa's small church in a college town. Not like Austin, though, kind of like a college station-like college town. And they went through a list together. They would just pray through a list of names. It started out as a couple dozen, but then over the course of those 20 to 30 years, that list grew to front and back 15 pages of names. They would just pray through every week. But over the course of those 20 to 30 years, you might imagine life was full, but also life was hard. Life got more and more difficult. They went through loss together, they went through heartache together, and they prayed through those tears. They sowed as well through those tears. They sowed seeds of the kingdom throughout those 20 years. One of them was a professor, and he would later become the assistant dean of the ag school. I heard the story that he would remember every student's name that he met. And so if you're at like a agricultural school and you're the assistant dean, you're meeting a lot of names and a lot of future farmers. And he would remember their names as a way of opening up future gospel conversations. It was a way to show, I care about you, and I want you to know why. My grandfather was also a professor, and he would host international students for months, for years, and he would he sponsored InterVarsity as a faculty member. The wildest part of this story to me, though, is a few weeks ago I found out that Nathan Herman, a member at Providence here, and he's an MVP of the youth volunteers, by the way, he was also on that list. We didn't know each other until 3 or 4 years ago. We met each other at Providence, didn't know anything of it, didn't think anything of it. And I found out a couple weeks ago that he was on this list. We were prayed for together for 20 to 30 years. I don't know why that makes me emotional. But 20 to 30 years after they prayed for this, after they invested in their sorrow, there's the fruit after, right? We're experiencing the fruit now. Nathan went with, you know, our high school guys, drove hours with them, spent hours with them in Colorado this summer, and has been with them for years, and he's doing wonderful work on campus as a PhD student. Haley, my sister, pours out her life for PK every week. I'm working in college ministry, and just think about the investment that they made. But they didn't taste the full fruit, right? We're not even tasting the full fruit now, but they never saw the fruit of their investment, of their work, of their sowing. But that wasn't in vain. And when we hear stories like that, at least when I think of stories like this, I think, wow, that is so cool that they did that. But that's not something I would do. But sowing the seeds of the kingdom, it's not complicated. It's not an amazing strategy that these men just like wrote up one day, like, oh wait, this is really gonna work. It's simple. It's a list of names that you pray for. It's sowing the seed of the kingdom in those spiritual conversations with your neighbor that might be a little awkward at first, but maybe the third conversation you bring up Jesus, you talk about him. That's sowing seed of the kingdom. Or it's with your kids at bedtime, and it's that eternal struggle of getting them in bed and getting them to go to sleep. And somehow you open up the storybook Bible, and you read a story from Ezekiel, and you suddenly start crying because it connects to Jesus. It's with your spouses and your arguments, and you're just in another one of those little spats. But one of you offers a word of grace, a word of gospel forgiveness. Or it's with your roommates that you might barely know, but God has given you them, and maybe one of them doesn't clean up his dishes, and he doesn't clean his room. That might have been me. But you offer constructive conversation about growing, but also forgiveness and grace. That is sowing the seed of the kingdom. Paul picks up this image in Galatians 6. He talks about sowing and reaping in the spirit rather than what we want, rather than sowing in the flesh. In his conclusion, his final statement is, don't grow weary of doing good. I think this is what the psalmist wants us to take away here. Don't lose heart in the desolate place. Jesus gives us an example of someone who sows in tears and reaps a harvest of joy. When we look to the life of Jesus, we see someone who feels the sorrow of the desert. He weeps at the tomb of Lazarus, knowing that moments later he's gonna raise him up. He's full of sorrow in the Garden of Gethsemane, asking God to take this cup, knowing that God will raise him up in 3 days. The hope of resurrection, the certainty of it, the amazing life that is found in it, it doesn't stop Jesus from sorrow. It doesn't preclude sorrow. If anything, it amplifies his sorrow. It's what Jesus does with his sorrow that counts. He brings it to God so that he can sow it into the kingdom. Jesus prays in the garden through his sorrow. And then he takes his sorrow to the path of the cross. He dies on the cross. And again, this is the way the world would write it up. This is the way these stories go. But then the surprise comes, the great reversal. On the third day, Jesus is raised from the dead. And think about that dejected and defeated group of disciples who desert him. Think how the resurrection affected them. That surprise, the joy of the resurrection. They take the gospel to the world through the Spirit. And that taking of the gospel to the world isn't some just pain-free, glorious work. They suffered unto death. They went out weeping, bearing the seed of the kingdom for sowing in the nations because they would come home with shouts of joy. In Christ, God has restored our fortunes. He's filled his people with laughter and joy and hope. So in our desolate place, we remember his resurrection, his restoration, and what it means to the world. We request that God would bring his kingdom now, in the foretaste of our lives now, by the same power that raised Jesus from the dead. And we go sowing as the work of the kingdom. We sow in the midst of our tears because we know we will reap shouts of joy, that we will be raised up with him to life eternal. We will bear the sheaves of joy. Let's pray.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.